Paul and Social Activism, the 22nd talk in a series on Ephesians, was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 16, 2018, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Jack Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to Jack Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 14, Paul and Social Activism, accompanies this talk.
Well, initially I planned on doing the next passage in Ephesians. It's famously the passage on spiritual armor, spiritual warfare. That is a much misunderstood passage. A lot of people take that passage to mean that we are engaged with magical spiritual weapons, and we use those magical spiritual weapons to wage war against the evil spirits and demons and Satan in the world, and we can help God thwart Satan's designs if we use those weapons. But that's not what he's saying. That doesn't fit into the purposes of Ephesians, and it just misconstrues the genre of the next passage. But I'll get there later. Well, 2 weeks from now, we'll look at that. What I wanted to do is take a little bit of time to answer some questions that were raised in emails this past week, and maybe expand that to talk a little bit more about Paul and social activism. And I'll explain why I'm taking the time to do that a little later. So first of all, I received this email. There's two emails, and I'm going to read virtually all of one and just some excerpts from a second one, but just so you know what I'm responding to. As you shared your thoughts about today's Christian culture and universities pushing for big platforms around social justice and the like, and as you gave your perspective on how our job really should be less about trying to write God's story for him, and instead to work to reconcile our place within this story, I got the sense you were essentially saying we should be working within the circumstances and opportunities in which we find ourselves, rather than seeking out a platform to change the world for the better, or how we define better, on some grand stage. Assuming I got the general gist of that position, my question had to do more with what it looks like to work within the circumstances and opportunities in which I'm placed. I guess I assumed you would find a lot of room between seeking a grand stage and working out my role, true? Or do you not see a lot of room in between? For example, if I were to give $100 to the Eugene Mission, is that working out my place in this story where I've been given more than I need and can put it towards helping those others in need? Or do you find that kind of gesture to fall into this platform for social justice? Another example, I don't usually give money to the panhandling homeless, but the other day I encountered a man I see a lot around our office building, and he had a gash on his head. He was asking for some Neosporin. I walked with him down the street and bought the medicine for him, and I guess I'm wondering if you find this kind of gesture to be more of an appeal for social justice on my part, or more of the working out my place in this story. Of course, there can be all kinds of motivations behind such gestures, prosperity gospel stuff, but just at some basic level, I'm curious where you judge actions to be more like an appeal to social justice and where they are working out my place in this story, because I am a character interacting with a lot of other characters every day. So that's the first email, and it's a good question, and to the extent that I wasn't clear, I very definitely want to clarify that today. But I subsequently received a second email, and here are a few excerpts from that second email that I want to address today publicly. How would you reflect your position on social activism in the following situations? One, you are President Abraham Lincoln facing the excruciating decision of whether or not to plunge your beloved country into a bloody, destructive war in order to abolish slavery. Two, you are a German citizen risking punishment or death in order to protect Jews in your neighborhood from certain death at the hands of the Nazis. Third, in your place of employment, you are aware of egregious sexual discrimination or abuse, and you risk your career in order to expose it. A little later in the email, you also denigrated the idea of believers taking a stand against social injustice just because it's the cool thing to do. Martin Luther King Jr. and William Wilberforce did not take heroic stands against slavery and racial bigotry because they were cool, but because they had deep convictions about the evil of those institutions. And then third point, no one who opposes evil in our society is morally pure. How would you esteem Martin Luther King's heroic and sacrificial efforts differently if he had not been a philanderer? Okay. Pertaining to none of that yet, well, not that's not altogether true, but Earl Craig called me to remind me that in the 7th chapter of his book, Works of Love, Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, has some very important things to say that are related to the issues that I raised last week and the issues that we're talking about today. And I would strongly recommend, if you can get a hold of Works of Love, read that, read the 7th chapter. Or if not, if you don't have a copy and you don't want to try to digest Kierkegaard, Earl has summaries of the chapters of Works of Love that he's posted online. And I don't know if you got the handout, but there should be a handout available, emailed to you. And in the handout, the link to those should be listed there. So I strongly recommend that you at least read his summary of the 7th chapter of Works of Love. Works of Love is a wonderful book if you need some good reading. Okay, to address these things, let me define some terms, because I think it's important that we define what we're talking about. I'm going to define an act of love, an act of mercy, an act of social justice activism, and an act of empty virtue signaling. We need to understand those four things. The first one is an act of love. I would define an act of love, and these definitions are not necessarily broad enough to encompass every circumstance, but as they relate to the issues that I'm talking about here. An act of love is acting in such a way that my action promotes the well-being of another human being in one way or another. So, for example, if I just give a gift to someone who doesn't need it, the gift that I'm giving them, they don't need it, they're not in need, but I give them a gift in order to do some good thing for them, that would be an act of love. Assuming that the gift that I gave them was not somehow indulging them and ended up being destructive in their life, that then it would not be an act of love. Then I'm being destructive by giving them this gift. But assuming that it's a good thing, it edifies them, it builds them up, it encourages them to be a better person, it makes their life better. As God would see good, it is good. Then by my doing that, I am loving them. So if I go and tutor a child in a wealthy family, but I do it for free, I'm just doing it because I want to be helping the family, I want to help the child needs help, and I tutor them and I don't charge for it, that would be an act of love. The fact that the child doesn't need it doesn't in any way diminish the fact that, the fact that the family doesn't need it being done for free doesn't diminish the fact that it's still a loving act on my part. Okay, that's an act of love. An act of mercy is acting in such a way that my action concretely and practically benefits someone who has been victimized or disadvantaged by societal structures or institutions that are evil or unjust. Now, it's also, it would be an act of mercy if I use mercy in the biblical sense to concretely and practically benefit someone who has been victimized or disadvantaged by God, by circumstances. God has sent along circumstances that have illness or, you know, they've been crippled or something has happened beyond their control that has disadvantaged them. If I come along and offer aid to them, that's also an act of mercy. I'm not primarily talking about that kind of act of mercy here. I'm talking about an act of mercy where the injury to them is coming because society is evil and the structures of society encourage evil and promote evil, and they have become disadvantaged or victimized by that. When I was a pastor in a large church with a large pastoral staff in California, there was a young pastor at that church who had a woman come to him with a story about a woman in East Palo Alto. East Palo Alto at the time, no longer I don't think, but at the time was basically a ghetto. It was where poorer people lived, disadvantaged people lived. And this African-American woman had been victimized by a kind of a scam where she had been encouraged to refinance her house, and to make a long story short, the whole scam managed to put her in a position where she could no longer afford to make the mortgage, and this mortgage company or whoever it was therefore going to foreclose on the house and get her property. And she had been completely taken advantage of and completely victimized by that. It was all legal. I mean, there wasn't any way that they could find any way to get at them legally. It was all legal, but it was completely immoral and unjust what they had done. So this young pastor, who didn't have a lot of money, decided that he would actually pay off the house for her, give her a loan to be able to pay an interest-free loan to pay off the house, and let her save her house, and then she would pay him back over time. That's an act of mercy. In contradistinction to what might he have done? He might have organized a bunch of people to go and make so much trouble for that mortgage company. I don't remember if that's what it was, but whatever that company was, he could have made trouble for them, bad publicity for them, boycotted them, I don't know, but taken some kind of action to really punish them for what they had done. That would be social activism, that we're going to rid our society of this particular injustice that is being done here. That would be social activism. But to simply help the victim of the injustice out, that's an act of mercy. I hope you see the difference, the distinction. Tutoring a child from that ghetto for free would have been an act of mercy, in a way that tutoring for free the child from the wealthy family was not an act of mercy, because that child probably has all kinds of advantages already and has not been damaged or victimized by the social structures. But the child in the ghetto likely has been. They don't have good schooling. Society has not provided good education for them. So to step in and try to help a particular child who has been disadvantaged by that, that's an act of mercy. Okay? I saw a documentary once about a prostitute who came to know the Lord, became a believer, and now runs an organization that is committed to rescuing prostitutes from that life of prostitution. And if they can introduce them to Jesus along the way, all the better. But but she's committed to rescuing prostitutes from their life. That's an act of mercy. She's not going to rid American culture of prostitution, of pornography, of sexual immorality. That I don't even think that's on her radar. But one person at a time, she can help individuals who have been victimized by those societal structures. She can rescue them and take them out. That's an act of mercy. Those are acts of mercy. Franklin Graham's organization, Samaritan's Purse, what do? They seek to provide economic and material relief to people who are in need for any number of reasons, including victims of various kinds of injustice. Is that social activism? No, not by my definition. It's not social activism, it's mercy. Those are particular acts of mercy on a larger scale, granted, but they're not going to wipe poverty off the face of the earth. I don't know, but I suspect they don't even think in terms of wiping poverty off the face of the earth. They're not going to be able to do that. But they can reach out to individuals who've been victimized by poverty and give them relief and help them and give them a helping hand. That's mercy. Those are acts of mercy. Okay, what do I, by social justice activism, I would define that as working to change the structures and institutions of a society in order to eliminate the evil and unjust outcomes that are encouraged and promoted by those structures and institutions. So social justice activism has as its target, as its goal, to change those structures and institutions. So, I gave the one example of organizing a group of people to protest and pressure the business who had sought to take advantage of that woman in East Palo Alto. Organizing a group of people to protest and pressure the school district to spend more money on the schools in the ghetto. That would be social activism, whereas tutoring an individual child is simply mercy. Joining the pro-life march in Washington coming up this next month, that I assume they're seeking to encourage not only the public, but to encourage judges and legislators to change their thinking, and hence to change the policies with respect to abortion. That is social justice activism, I would argue. Okay. Picketing and protesting in front of abortion clinics, I know there's lots of different things that go on there. Many of those protesters and picketers are probably reaching out to individuals to try to rescue them and show them mercy. But I would think, maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm misinterpreting it, but I think that large in their agenda is to for their protesting and picketing to eventually rid society of the scourge and the evil of abortion. That's social justice activism, I think. Okay. Then one final definition, an act of empty virtue signaling. An act of empty virtue signaling is acting in such a way and with such a purpose that my action signals to onlookers, or at least it's meant to signal to onlookers, that I am a righteous and morally upright individual who passionately cares about justice and about other people, even though the action itself that I'm taking does little or nothing to promote the well-being of any other human being. For me, the classic example of this was back when I was in college. I remember encountering some people who would spend their lunch hour going to the county courthouse in San Mateo County, standing on the steps with a little button that you could barely see, opposing the war in Vietnam. That struck me as pretty odd. At least the SDS was breaking windows all over campus and doing something pretty dramatic. no one was concretely being helped by what they were doing. And so I was asking myself, why are they doing this? It was for themselves. It's so they could tell themselves and anyone else who kind of could see it, look what a moral person I am, that I am opposed to this evil war in Southeast Asia. Most of what Jesus accused the Pharisees of being guilty of, maybe I shouldn't say most, but one of the important things that Jesus accused the Pharisees of being guilty of, for example, giving alms to be seen by men, and not only giving them alms to be seen by men, but having somebody blow a trumpet before they did it so people could take notice of it, that's the classic example of virtue signaling. And the Pharisees were experts in virtue signaling. Their whole life was given over to one kind of virtue signaling or another. Having been a card-carrying expert Pharisee myself for so many years, and having tried to study that, I think I understand Phariseeism. And it comes in different flavors. There's a God-believing Phariseeism, and there's a secular atheistic Phariseeism. But any way you cut it, it's Phariseeism. It doesn't really make any difference whether it's in the context of belief in God or not. Phariseeism is still Phariseeism. And virtue signaling is just the old-fashioned term for virtue signaling is Phariseeism. Declaring loudly and passionately to others that I support individuals who are being taken advantage of by businesses at work in the ghetto. You know, that's what we as a church could have done in response to the lady in East Palo Alto that I was talking about. We could have spoken out loudly and passionately that it was wrong and then walked away. That would have simply been virtue signaling. We didn't do anything. We didn't accomplish anything. We didn't help anybody, but we sure let everybody know how righteous we were and how much we cared for people and how just we were, how much justice was a big deal to us. That's what John was talking about when he said, my brethren, don't love in word only, but in deed and in truth. You know, if you're going to love, then do something about it. Don't talk love, do love. Okay, that's probably good enough. So, with those definitions in mind, my understanding of what Paul's perspective would be is that the righteousness that a Jesus follower is called to pursue necessarily includes acts of love and acts of mercy, necessarily. In fact, I go so far as to say that the biblical perspective, Paul's perspective, Jesus' perspective is, if I'm not committed to acts of love or acts of mercy, then how am I a believer? That's what James was getting at when he said, faith without works is dead. Can that faith save you? He said. We don't have saving faith if my faith, my belief that Jesus is the Messiah, does not lead me to the point where I'm committed to taking whatever opportunities present themselves to me to love other people and to be merciful to other people. That's not really an option. Okay, so in every case, we need to take seriously our obligation to act in love and in mercy. I would add to that then, if and when God calls a particular individual to play a particular role in changing society, if and when God does that, then the righteousness of that Jesus follower, the righteousness that a Jesus follower is called to pursue, may include acts of social justice activism. That's true, it might. There may be the time and place where God has called me to take steps to try to actually change something about my society, remove some of the structures and institutions that are promoting and encouraging and propagating evil and victimizing people unjustly. It might. But there's nothing in Paul or in Jesus or the Bible that calls every believer, because he's a believer, to that. And maybe we can talk more about that in a second. I would make a proviso, though. However, it will be acts of social justice activism that are righteous, of the righteous sort, not acts of social justice activism of the unrighteous sort. There's all kinds of things that we can do to try to affect a change in society that are not necessarily righteous things to do. Nihilism, in its original political sense, arose in Russia in the 1860s. And the idea of nihilism was the whole structure of Russian society absolutely stinks and is unjust and is evil. We need to literally destroy it all. We need to destroy it all and bring it down and create a blank slate where we can build our utopian society on top of a new foundation. And not just patch this one, but literally start over and build it up again. Well, nihilism is just purely destructive. I'm just going to bring it down for the sake of bringing it down so that we can build a better future. Much of what goes on today in the name of social justice activism is nihilism. It's a new version, a new modern form of nihilism. And I would argue there's nothing righteous about nihilism. That's not a righteous response. It's not a righteous kind of activism. So we have to be discerning. God may have called me to try to make a change and make a difference in the structures of our society, but I need to figure out how can I do it righteously rather than unrighteously. My next point is that the righteousness that a Jesus follower is called to pursue will never include acts of empty virtue signaling. That is never authentic righteousness. It's not true righteousness. Never has been, never will be. Now, there's a common mistake that seems to be made in the reasoning of a lot of modern Christians, and that is to argue that we are under obligation to engage in acts of social justice activism. Every one of us as believers is under obligation to do so, because the Bible instructs us to love our neighbor. Or, to put it in the terms that I just defined above, arguing that we are under obligation to engage in acts of social justice activism because the Bible clearly instructs us to engage of acts of love and mercy. So they fail to make the distinction between an act of mercy or an act of love on the one hand and an act of social justice activism on the other. And because the Bible commands one, instructs us to engage in one, well, they take it as an instruction to engage in the other. The Bible instructs us to be merciful, so we take that as instructing us to change society and change the evil structures and unjust structures that we find there. That's fallacious. It doesn't follow. It's not true, I would argue. Note that Paul in Ephesians is clearly and unmistakably calling the masters of slaves to engage in acts of love and acts of mercy toward their slaves. There's no question about that. And he spends as much time telling the slaves to do that, maybe not as much time, but he gives equal force to the masters doing that toward their slaves as he does telling the slaves to be subordinate to their masters. But and this is what's remarkable, remarkably, Paul himself is clearly refraining from engaging in any social justice activism with regard to the institution of slavery. And he's clearly not exhorting his readers to engage in any social justice activism with regard to the institution of slavery. Now, we have that. That's what's true in Ephesians, right? It's all about exhorting people to love and mercy in obedience to their true Lord and Master Jesus. That's what he's exhorting them. He's not even calling the institution into question in Ephesians. You have another place in the New Testament where Paul confronts slavery. It's in the book of Philemon. Philemon, as you know, was a master of a slave named Onesimus. Onesimus ran away. He escaped. Running away from your masters in the Roman Empire was really a dangerous thing to do. Often death was the outcome. He ran away from his master. He made his way to Rome. Somewhere in Rome, he comes into contact with Paul and he becomes a believer. Okay, so now what? Onesimus is a believer. Philemon is also a believer. Paul writes a letter to Philemon and he sends Onesimus back. He doesn't come out in so many words and say it, but he all but says to Philemon, I really think you should grant Onesimus his freedom. So it's really quite clear that Paul is not a fan of the institution of slavery. He sees it as utterly incongruent with the truth about what human beings are, and certainly incongruent with who believers are. He makes it clear to Philemon, Onesimus is your equal in the Lord. So it's certainly incongruent with that. But not once does he say, you know, this evil scourge, Jesus called us to put an end to this kind of stuff. This really, you know, it's outrageous that we wouldn't end slavery and end it now. We've got to do everything we can to end it. I mean, the kinds of things that we would say, Paul's not saying. But he all but tells Philemon to set him free, telling Philemon, you know, if Onesimus owes you anything, I'll pay it back to you. And by the way, Philemon, you kind of owe me your life. Just saying, just so you know, you owe your life to me. He's basically saying, if not for conscience sake, if not for anyone else's sake, for my sake, to whom you owe your whole life, would you maybe consider that the redemption fee to let Onesimus go? That's clearly between the lines, I think. So, yes, is he calling on Philemon to be merciful and to be loving? Absolutely. Is he trying to change the institution within the Roman Empire so the Roman Empire no longer has such an unjust institution? Not even close. You don't even get any kind of hint that he thinks that is interesting to him. Today, we have a distinctive stream within evangelical Christianity that has adopted the view that to declare support for certain social-political policies is an act of love. We are loving if we declare support for these social-political policies, and conversely, we're haters if we don't declare support for those policies. We're hateful people. Specifically, because as believers, we are obligated to love our neighbors, they argue, we are thereby obligated to openly declare our support for social political policies that, for example, transfer wealth from the wealthy to the poor. And correspondingly, if we balk at those policies that, for example, transfer wealth from the wealthy to the poor, then we are failing to love our neighbor. We are failing to practice righteousness, and we call the authenticity of our discipleship into question. We can't really be followers of Jesus if we're not supportive of those policies. And I'm just picking that as one example. There are many examples I could give, but pick the policy that love for your neighbor requires that you declare your support and you be on board as behind that policy. And if not, then you're a hater. You know, Well, whether we should embrace a social political policy, what a particular policy, we'd have to take each policy on its own merits and evaluate it in its own right. But in any case, even if the policy is a valid policy, it's fallacious to suggest that to do so is necessarily an act of love. And I must emphasize necessarily. Could it be an act of love on the part of an individual? Well, of course. If your heart and your spirit is exactly what Jesus is asking of us, and it's out of that spirit that I'm acting, then of course it is. But is it necessarily an act of love, as we would be inclined or would be encouraged to believe? Well, two comments in that regard. When it costs me nothing to support such policies, it's usually little more than empty virtue signaling on my part, rather than an actual act of love to openly support such policies. I mean, how hard is it for me to go, you know what? I think those wealthy people have way too much money. Some of their money should go to the poor people in this country. That is so easy for me to say. But if it's getting me all kinds of brownie points, is that really why I'm saying it? Am I really concerned about justice? Am I really concerned about the poor? Or is this about me? Is this about me signaling to an audience that's ready to hear that and ready to give me brownie points and credit for that, that I'm such a good boy, that that's why I'm supporting it? If it does cost me something, it is still, more often than not, an attempt to establish my own righteousness rather than actually be an act of love. This is the mistake that anyone makes who is not actually believing the good news of the gospel, but is rather seeking to establish his own righteousness. Paul's talking about that in Romans when he says that's what the Jews are doing. The Jews are, having rejected the dikaiosune that comes from God, they're seeking to establish their own dikaiosune. That their obedience is not true righteousness. Their obedience is their own attempt in their own eyes and in the eyes of others to make themselves worthy of God's blessing. When I do good to you to establish my own righteousness, I'm not loving you. Right? When the reason I'm doing good to you is so that I can establish how righteous I am, this is not love for you. I'm not acting in love for you. You're a prop to my own self-justification. Okay. So there's so many ways that that even if it costs me my embracing certain social political policies are not really about love and therefore not really about authentic righteousness. Furthermore, in the example that I explicitly offered above, transferring wealth from the wealthy to the poor, arguably, there are many people who argue that that's actually immoral, and it's the opposite of love to support such a policy. Why? Because they're convinced, as the French thinker Bastiat wrote in his book, The Laws, as Bastiat argued, I would be supporting a policy that advocates using the power of the state to steal from one group in order to give it to another. There was a famous essay written back in the early part of the 20th century where the term the forgotten man comes from. The one who made that famous was FDR, but FDR actually inverted the meaning of the term. In the original essay, in the original article, the forgotten man was, if I'm the politician and David over here is the poor person and Ken here is the taxpaying American, Ken is the forgotten man. Because I'm deciding what David needs and I am robbing Ken in order to pay David what I, the politician, have decided that he needs. And the one, who's the one who's forgotten in the whole mix and who never really had a say in the matter? The one who's having to cough up the money. That's the forgotten man. Well, that's what Bastiat is talking about a century earlier. Because, now, it's quite clearly unbiblical and righteous to act evilly and unlovingly against one person in order to do good to another. So if that analysis is correct, then it's clearly biblically immoral to steal from the wealthy to give to the poor. Okay, let's apply these concepts to the questions raised in the emails. To support the Eugene mission, is that social activism or is that an act of mercy? I would argue that's an act of mercy. I don't know everything there is to know about the Eugene mission. Maybe there are some aspects of what they do which would be better analyzed as engaging in social activism, but most of what I am aware of them doing is reaching out to individuals who've been victimized in one way or another by injustices and stuff, evil in our society, and helping them. That's mercy. Of course we're called to that. That's always appropriate to do that. By giving $100 to the mission, am I ridding the world of poverty and homelessness and the evil and injustice that leads to those things? Of course not. No, I'm not going to do that. But am I making a big, huge difference in the life of certain individuals? Absolutely. So it would be, as an act of mercy, a very worthy thing to do. Exactly, I would answer the same way about taking the homeless man to buy some Neosporin. That's an act of mercy, clearly. The Good Samaritan, the parable of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan is not engaged in social justice activism. He is exercising mercy, showing mercy and love. In the next email, we had the example of Abraham Lincoln. He was faced with a choice to lead the whole nation to address a grave social injustice. That, I would argue, was in fact social justice activism. Yeah, that seems like you have to analyze it that way. He was wanting to change a fundamental structure within American culture of that day, or at least half the states. So yes, that was social justice activism. But notice that like William Wilberforce before him, Lincoln found himself in a position of power and authority whereby he could transform the structures and institutions of American culture. Human beings, it's a rare situation where we find ourselves with the social latitude, we find ourselves in a position where we have the influence and the power and the authority to be able to accomplish those kinds of changes. If we do find ourselves in that position, should my actions be governed by justice? Absolutely. No question about it. But most of us are not in that position, and most of us never will find ourselves in that position. So that's a very unusual kind of circumstance. The German protecting Jews from the Nazis, again, that's not social justice activism. That would be an act of mercy. It's a very costly act of mercy, very dangerous act of mercy, but you are risking your life to help somebody else out in very, very dangerous and desperate straits. But you're not going to change Nazi society of the day by doing that. so it doesn't fall into the category of what I'm calling social justice activism. And I'd offer the same thing: a person seeking to redress the wrong of sexual discrimination or abuse in an office, the same answer. I think it's an act of mercy, not social justice activism. Granted, you might be able to change the culture of the office. That may very well be. But you haven't changed society, the very culture that gave birth to that office culture to begin with is still alive and well, and it's still there, and you probably haven't put a dent in it. Okay, now the objection you're going to raise is, okay, but Jack, you've constructed a big straw man here. You've defined social justice activism in such a way that no one would ever say that you have to do that in order to truly be righteous and an authentic disciple of Jesus. Surely what those people mean is you have to be willing to engage in acts of mercy and acts of love in order to be an authentic disciple of Jesus. And I've already agreed, if that's what they were saying, I'd agree with that. That's true. So have I created a straw man by saying, oh no, but there are these other people who are saying you actually have to engage in social justice activism in order to be an authentic disciple of Jesus? Well, I don't know, maybe. You're going to have to answer that for yourself. From my days in college onward, continuously, without any break, I have continually run into Christians who, with respect to one social issue or another, have remarked repeatedly that Christians call the authenticity of their faith into question because they're not doing anything to eliminate the particular evil or suffering that they have focused on, that they've put their finger on. Sex trafficking. How can you claim to be a believer when you're not doing a single cotton-picking thing to stop it? How can you possibly call yourself a believer? Now, take your pick, no matter what that social evil is. Does that not resonate? Haven't you heard people taking that position that you are somehow calling the authenticity of your faith into question because you don't care enough to do something to eliminate that evil in society? It might be poverty, it might be racial prejudice, it might be the war in Vietnam, it might be abortion. I've heard it with respect to all four of those during the course of my lifetime. I went online and found this. I just want to, this is Exhibit A. This is NPR. This is an excerpt of an interview that they had on NPR. And I'm just going to read the whole thing. It's only a page and a half. Attorney General Jeff Sessions quoted the Bible in defense of President Trump's immigration policy, calling for the temporary separation of children from their parents. Sessions cites the command in Romans 13 to obey the laws of the government because God has ordained the government for his purposes. Among those who disagree with Sessions are a small group of evangelicals known as red-letter Christians. They eschew politics altogether, saying they choose instead to follow Jesus' teachings, feeding the poor, sheltering immigrants, and tending to the sick. Here in Now's Robin Young talks with Don Golden, executive director of Red Letter Christians, about the group and its conflicts with conservative evangelicals. And now what we have here are just interview highlights, and what they've done is listed a topic and then quoted Don Golden in response to that topic. So the interview highlights on the thinking behind the group, quote, "Our premise is that to take the words of Jesus seriously, you have to take the poor seriously. You have to take the marginalized seriously. You have to take immigrants seriously, and you can't take some of the current Republican politics seriously, or at least commit yourselves to them and be consistent with the words of Jesus." Topic on what it means to be an evangelical. David Bebbington, the church historian, gives a classic definition that someone who is committed to the seriousness of the Bible, who's committed to the centrality of the cross, and who's committed to taking the message out to other people. And so within Bebbington's definition, it's pretty broad. Many of us in red letter Christianity would consider ourselves still evangelicals. On the component of evangelizing and spreading the word, quote, "That's one of the key phrases, but you know, when Jesus stood up to kind of give his mission statement, it's recorded in Luke 4, he's quoting from Isaiah, and he says, 'Proclaim good news to the poor.' And that word 'good news' in Greek is euangelion, where we get the word evangel. And so the central theme and message of evangelicalism is a liberation message to the poor. Liberation to prisoners, recovery of sight to the blind, setting the oppressed free, and proclaiming the year of the Lord's favor." So evangelicalism at its heart has the poor at the center. On Evangelical Inc. and how politics is shaping the religion, I'm not sure what Evangelical Inc. is, but there's a crisis in America right now. If you look at the UN report on poverty that just came out, 40 million poor people in America, there are 18 million of those who are extremely poor, and 5.3 million of those live in third world level poverty. And yet at the same time, we've just experienced a tax cut that's removed $1.5 trillion of money from essential services, mostly benefiting the wealthy. And those are issues of supreme gospel importance, of importance to the poor, the marginal, the weak. And so any type of Christianity that becomes co-opted by a political party, especially a party that is associated with these types of policies, is toxic. On evangelical leader Jerry Falwell Jr.'s president of Liberty University and Red Letter Christians' efforts to meet with him, quote, "We issued a public, first a private, and then a public request to talk with him and to debate with him, would Jesus support Donald Trump? If you want to know how faithful a people are to the God of the Bible, you look at not their religious buildings or how huge their campuses are, you look at the condition of the widow, the orphan, and the poor. And I think our direct confrontation and the spirit of the Jewish prophets to confront power that is undermining and threatening the already vulnerable, I think that it is considered threatening that I would say that fear is the main thing that permeated the atmosphere of Lynchburg, Virginia. People live in fear of what Jerry Falwell will say about anyone who would challenge that form of Christianity that's so closely aligned with political power. Lynchburg is really just a sort of microcosm of the greater America. There are many in so-called Evangelical Inc. who are appalled by many of the policies coming out, not just from this president, for many years even, from the religious right and from the governments that the religious right support. But the fear that exists in one's reputation or one's pocketbook and potentially losing your salary, people don't speak out." I think he said for fear that exists. It's exactly that kind of sentiment that permeates the comments by the red letter Christians there that I would argue, where is that coming from? And why, this is why I'm taking time to talk about this today. If you sat through the series, The Crisis of Faith, that I gave, I don't know, a couple years back, and what I argued is that postmodern Christianity is the biggest crisis facing true faith today. That permeating academia, the media, Hollywood, the bureaucracy, the political class, the journalistic class, most of the institutions of our society are sold on a religious worldview. They have a religious commitment to a particular worldview, and it's what I called postmodern secular progressivism. That's a mouthful, so I'm going to call it, people who are committed to that, I'm going to call POSPers. So that's what I mean by POSPers. The people that permeate those institutions are POSPers. They're committed to POSPerism, as a religion, as a religious worldview. The worldview of posperism is fundamentally inimical to the worldview of the Bible. It just is. It's a radically different worldview. And the values and the priorities and the beliefs and so on that emerge from the worldview of posperism are in conflict with the beliefs and the values that come out of biblical Christianity. I don't recognize any of the people that the red letter Christians are talking about when they say, you know, all they're worried about is their pocketbook and they're just afraid. They're just fearful people. There may be those people out there, but I don't know any of them. The believers that I know, and you all know I'm not a fan of evangelicalism. I've put myself standing against evangelicalism in so many ways. I'm not a fan of evangelicalism. For all of its faults, what evangelicalism, the reason they are opposed to posperism is because it is a contrary religion, not because they're afraid of their pocketbooks or their way of life or something like that. Evangelicals are among the most generous and open-hearted people that I know, for all of their faults. And to call them haters is nothing but slander. It is absolutely slanderous. They don't even know an evangelical if they make that kind of claim. Now, there may be pockets of them in different parts of the country and different cultures that their evangelicalism isn't even authentic evangelicalism. I mean, that may very well be. And maybe those charges can be justly leveled at them. But the idea that someone can call themselves a Christian, let alone an evangelical, when their worldview, I would argue, is clearly inimical to the worldview of the Bible. It's not coming from a biblical set of values and beliefs. They borrowed it from their culture, from the academia, from the journalists, from the media, from ESPN. You know, the whole culture is permeated by this religious viewpoint that has an orthodox set of beliefs and values, and don't you dare stray from them. And so there's a set of Christians who have obediently stepped in line and are espousing those same values that their secular counterpart is espousing. That's where this stuff is coming from. This is not coming from the Bible. The quotations from the scripture show nothing but a complete ignorance on his part of what the biblical message actually is. Just because it uses the word poor in the sentence doesn't mean that the poor are at the center of the gospel message. That is just nonsense, and it's complete ignorance. Now, should we have compassion for the poor? Absolutely. There's no question about that. But that doesn't make it the center of the message. There's a lot of people we should have compassion for. So the reason I'm taking the time with this is because I really think this is a crisis in our culture. We're going to have to make up our mind. What do we want to do? Embrace a Christianity that is made as palatable as possible to the culture, larger culture out there that we live in? Or do we want to stay true and authentic to the teaching of Jesus and the apostles themselves? We can't have it both ways. The ones who are going to be hated are the people who follow Jesus and seek to learn his truth and his wisdom and live in the light of that. I need to leave you time. Just one last thing here. I quoted in the second email that I had said that social justice activism was cool. That's actually not what I said. You can go back and listen to the tape if you want. What I was doing is making a distinction between two different kinds of social justice activism. There's the cool kind, and there's the uncool kind. There's all kinds of social injustice. There's all kinds of injustice in our country. But you're not going to find a social justice warrior among us who's going to be willing to get behind every instance of social injustice. Try to get a POSPR or a postmodern Christian to join you in organizing a march against sex outside of marriage. Good luck with that. Or to get you to join in organizing a march against gambling. Is gambling an injustice? It's an awful evil. When my father was the district attorney in Klamath County, the biggest problem in Klamath County decades ago was gambling. The wives and children of gamblers were left utterly and completely impoverished because the man had gambled all their money away. It's a terrible scourge in the lives of some people, but try to get a march against gambling in our society. Try to organize a march against academic policies that discriminate against Asians and Jews. Probably not going to happen. Organize a march that is against anti-Semitism in the United Nations. Probably not going to happen. Or a march against the atrocities of radical Islamists, or for that matter, MS-13. Or voter fraud. Or the justice system's abuse of plea bargaining. Try to get that to happen. All of those are injustices. All of those are evils in our society, in our culture. But not all of those things would get you brownie points for opposing them and speaking out against them. They're going to get you nowhere. And some of them, you even get points taken away from you for speaking out against them. What about Martin Luther King? If he had not been a womanizer, would I have looked at him differently? If that was the case, I would view him the same way I view Wilberforce right now. Grateful to God that God acted in history to right some very serious wrongs and use that man to do it. But because I lack sufficient knowledge to know whether, as an individual, he was a genuine child of God, I'm just kind of agnostic and, you know, whatever. God used him. God clearly used him. God used him by making him act very heroically and sacrificially, and that's great. But I can't say more than that. I'm not going to call him righteous when I don't know if he's righteous. Kierkegaard's contribution, if you get a chance to read the Works of Love thing, Kierkegaard's contribution is his emphasis on inwardness over external acts. God is calling us to authentic righteousness, but authentic righteousness is a matter of inwardness, not merely external actions. So in the light of that, God's agenda, as we've seen in Ephesians, is not to make the world and society a better place. Nowhere does he say that in Ephesians. But all over the place, he's saying that God's agenda is to create a body of individuals, each of whom is marked by righteousness in their inward parts, in their inwardness, in the depth of the spirit. In the depth of their spirit, they're authentically committed to the righteousness of God. Okay, we've got 10 minutes anyway. Push back at me if you want to. I'm a big boy, I can take it.
One of the things that doesn't get addressed is the collectivism of the effort, in that God may indeed be calling person A to act on a issue and may be calling person B to not act on that issue. And the first time I ever thought about this was, I think Charlie Dewberry was trying to convince me that there were righteous Nazis. And he said, if you grew up in Germany under Hitler, who controlled the radio stations, who controlled the newspapers, who controlled every bit of information that came through your ears. And they called you up to defend the fatherland against invasion. What would you do? He said you would salute and march to the front with a happy heart, knowing that you were doing the right thing. And it hit me that, yeah, that would be the right choice. Because all you had to go on was what you had been fed daily for most of your life. You didn't know that it was all a lie. You didn't know that you were being used. On the other hand, your next door neighbor may have been one of those hiding Jews smuggling information out through Switzerland that helped Germans get killed. But God made you both of them as righteous in their heart.
Right.
And it was a tough argument. We went round and round on it, but I had to admit, yeah, you only know what you know, and you go with your heart. And so on some of these issues, it seems to me that a Christian would be faithful to act on them, just as the one sitting next to them would have been faithful to not act on them. There were people, and this is what made me think, but there were people 20 years or so ago that were going to Africa and buying slaves, Christian groups. And there were people sitting next to them saying, don't do this. Market forces will, and that's what happened. As soon as Christians started buying slaves and setting them free, which is an amazing gift and a loving thing to do, the slave brokers raised their prices. Then they used the higher profits to go out and capture more slaves, which they then brought back and sold at higher prices, which created open-air slave markets again in parts of Africa that hadn't seen them in hundreds of years. They actually increased the slave problem.
Had the opposite effect.
And so the person who was motivated in the beginning to go set slaves free could have been acting on God's call. Just as the person sitting next to them who understood mankind and market forces crying out to these people, don't start this, could also have been acting with a righteous heart.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that individuality of God's call in our lives and our role in whatever quote-unquote movement we may be involved in that seems to be completely overlooked and unforgiven in most of these comments.
I know I've come in on this before, but I feel so keenly when I was younger how much what I call a puritanical impulse was at work in me. I really believed that I needed to keep my life as pure and spotless and just and righteous as could be. And I needed to eliminate all vestiges of evil within me, and that's what I was called to as a believer. Well, it was just completely and utterly naive, because what I did not understand at that point in my life was how utterly and deeply and fundamentally depraved I was. Of course I'm not going to be able to rid myself of every vestige of evil. It goes so deep that, I mean, it leaks out of my pores. So, of course, so the idea that I really want to work to be pure in that sense is naive and misguided. But oftentimes the actions that we take are often motivated by, okay, I'm not going to be a part of this unjust system. I'm going to rid myself of any connection with this unjust system. And it finally dawned on me one day, well, I have to stop breathing then, because breathing is contributing to the environment and the economy and the structures. I mean, I'm doing my part to contribute to it. If I really believe in indirect guilt in the way that I did, then I'd have to stop breathing. And that's absurd. That's ridiculous.
Jack, just a couple of comments. When you said that if it doesn't cost me anything, you know, it's just but I'm on the bandwagon. It's just bringing attention to myself as a righteous, good living person, citizen. You know, I was thinking about a couple of issues. The immigration issue. We have had several of our families come over from Denmark, and then our church during the Vietnam crisis sponsored a family. But in each one of those cases, when you brought over an immigrant, you had to provide housing for them, and you had to provide work for them. And so I was just thinking, and I've thought about this whole immigration thing that we're up against, but you know, I wonder how many takers they would get if they just put out a cost for each one of those immigrant families and see how many takers they had. You know, because then you're looking at it entirely, you know, in a different light. And then the other night we went to the shed for the White Christmas deal, and we were walking in, and I should have, because I read it in the paper, but somebody was handing out a slip of paper, and I didn't read it until I got inside. And it was the whole idea of supporting the homeless downtown right next to the shed, and the shed had written a paper to the city council, I guess, saying that they didn't want them there because of all the crap they had to pick up around their place. And I wish I was going to hit them up when we left, but they were gone. I wonder how many takers they would have if they said, I was going to tell them, well, why don't you invite, you know, three or four of them to put their tents up in your backyard, and you can let them use your restroom and maybe even take them to a street corner in the morning or whatever, and how many takers you would have, you know, on the, it's just seems kind of funny. You know, nobody really wants a homeless camp in their neighborhood, but they'll sure support a homeless camp somewhere, you know, somewhere else. But it's all these issues that come up that I can get on a bandwagon, but it really doesn't cost me anything.
Yeah. And nothing convicts me more in the scripture than the obligation that we do have to be merciful and to be loving. I mean, nothing points out my selfishness and my self-centeredness and my desire to not be inconvenienced more than confronting the reality that there are all kinds of people out there that I could reach out to and love that I probably am actually not willing to do that. Shame on me. But that's different than changing the world. That's changing me. That's what I need to change, is me. Anything else?
Yeah, Jack, I'm wondering if you would be willing to comment on the point that I think Tyler raised last week that I referred to in an email message to you. When, how should we view ourselves in relation to a particular social evil as being perhaps the person that God is going to use to make the change that it's consistent with his character?
Mm-hmm.
And when should we say, well, I don't see God really working in that way right here, right now, so I'm not going to really do anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, it comes back to what Logan was saying. I think we just all have to stand before God as individuals on any and every question like that. You know, what, God, what do you want me to do? If God, to use the vernacular, lays it on my heart. If God lays it on my heart to do something about that, then the next step is, what do you want me to do? And it would be one thing. I could see in my foolishness, I could discharge my sense of responsibility by just doing something that has no effect, doesn't change anything, doesn't accomplish anything, but I'm doing something. Well, if God really wants to change the world, he's going to lead me to do something that actually has an effect and changes things. So that would just be folly on my part. That would be like Don Quixote. You know, I'm just out there in my imagination obeying God and being used by God against some awful evil, but not really. That's not really what's happening. How do I know what to do and whether it's going to be effective, I don't know. I mean, I am often baffled by the American Revolution. How did they know they could pull it off? I don't know, but I think they just felt the energy. God is doing something. This, what a great opportunity. The winds of change. You know, it's Bob Dylan, you know. The times there are changing. And when you feel the times are changing, then you realize I'm not the only one who feels it. There are these other people as well. And you start talking to each other and you can together decide, you know, maybe we can do something here. Let's act. And can that be from God? I think so.
Your answer makes it sound like the test is really pragmatism. Did my efforts make a difference or not? I'm not sure that's the right test.
Well, no. No, I'm not saying that. I mean, God may call me to be completely and utterly ineffective. Jeremiah is the great example. That's fine, too. That's his business. But again, it's just as an individual before God. Am I being foolish and quixotic here, or am I simply being obedient to God and nothing is happening, but God never promised me that anything would happen? Those are two entirely different things spiritually. And I can't answer that for you. You can't answer that for me. You know, we got to work that out in the quiet of our own relationship with our Creator, I think.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, God, let you go. Thanks. We'll look at spiritual warfare next week.